It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll get some great ideas for lunchbox treats as the kids head back to school.
First, a federal appeals court ruling came down yesterday with a three-judge panel deciding unanimously that the same-sex marriage bans in Wisconsin and Indiana are unconstitutional.
The ruling came 9 days after the judges heard oral arguments in the case, during which Judge Richard Posner put very challenging questions to the attorneys from Wisconsin and Indiana defending the ban.
Yesterday's ruling also came a day after a federal judge in New Orleans ruled in favor of maintaining Louisiana's ban on same-sex marriage. Since the Supreme Court ruled on the matter last year, every federal judge to hear a state case had ruled against same-sex marriage bans.
As it stands, same-sex marriages have not resumed here in Wisconsin, and Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen's office has said he will appeal the decision to the Supreme Court.
It remains to be seen if the Supreme Court will take this case or another case that could reach the court ahead of Wisconsin's. Here with us now to talk about the future of Wisconsin's same-sex marriage law is Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back.
Good afternoon. How are you, folks?
Doing pretty well. How about yourself?
Good, good. So it's been quite an exciting time for gay marriage across the federal courts this last week.
Exactly. A lot of action, and as we talked about, some of it contradictory, but we're going to start with Wisconsin. A 40-page decision yesterday and a unanimous ruling against the ban. What do you make of that ruling?
Well, you know, Judge Posner has always been known for having incisive critiques. He is a Reagan appointee and is considered to be conservative. At one time, he and Scalia were actually considered to be kind of ideological equals in some ways. But Posner has always sort of parted company and stayed focused on different issues. There's been a little bit of a challenge between the two of them. You've seen some kind of dickering between Posner and Scalia. And so that's why his decision is really quite striking. And it was not such a surprise. No one is surprised by it because his oral arguments 9 days ago, I mean, some people said he was bordering on mocking the state's attorney generals with questions. So it's not that much of a surprise that he came down the way he did.
And as we said, there was a 40-page decision there. Can you hit some of the highlights for us on what it contained?
I think part of what Posner is trying to do is to systematically go through, and while he can't address all of those cases out there, remember, we've had 21 opinions now out of federal courts with a wide variety of different arguments, and it seems pretty clear what Posner was trying to do, and he's known for his legal writing, is to try to crystallize those arguments and pretty much tear them apart. And that's part of the reason why you see it being both so long and also why he goes into great detail to address the different arguments between Indiana and Wisconsin. But much of it boils down to these critical arguments. What interest can the state show to justify why they want to ban same-sex marriage? And that typically falls into protecting traditional marriage. Traditional marriage will be undervalued. There's this concern about children and the need for children to remain with biological parents. Indeed, in Judge Martin Feldman's ruling, who was out of Louisiana, and Feldman stands as the lone judge in all of these cases to uphold same-sex marriage bans, you know, Feldman goes into great detail about the issue regarding children and upbringing and the well-being of children in heterosexual versus homosexual families, and as a justification for the state for why it has an interest in protecting heterosexual marriage. And so Posner systematically went through and said, you know, the reason why it's a harm to children is because you don't acknowledge gay marriage. And if you would acknowledge, you say on the one hand that, that marriage is important for protecting children, and yet on the other hand, you don't allow gay couples who have children that same ability to protect their children by being in a married and committed relationship, your argument's not making any sense. And then going into greater detail, Posner did, about, well, then, you know, what is the state of marriage? And if we look at the state of children inside and outside of wedlock and the numbers that Wisconsin and Indiana, the attorney generals, are putting forward as justification for why they want to take the position they do, just doesn't hold up when you look at the numbers and the social science evidence. And so that's what Posner was doing.
any chance that the length of this decision and the forcefulness of it could be seen as baiting the Supreme Court to pick it up?
Absolutely. And not only that, here's the key thing. That decision came down 9 days after the oral arguments. Compare that to, on average, an appeals case will take anywhere from 6 months to a year. I believe Feldman took almost a year in his opinion. The fact that the Seventh Circuit moved so quickly, many people are looking at that and going, Posner, are you trying to, like, sort of yank the chain of the Supreme Court and let them know, hey, I'm out here? And don't forget that there, you know, there are 32 states that have asked the Supreme Court to settle gay marriage. Some of those states are pro-gay marriage. Some have prohibitions on gay marriage. But 32 of the states have said, we want you to look at three cases out of Virginia, Utah, and Oklahoma and overturn those bans. And by the decision out of the Seventh Circuit happening so quick, being so detailed, it most certainly is going to be sitting there waiting to be included into those cases that I would say almost certainly the Supreme Court is now going to have to consolidate and decide.
Does it work that way? Does the Supreme Court look at this and read the message, you know, pick up one of these guys and react?
Well, you know, now we're all reading tea leaves on how the Supreme Court is going to act. But certainly it has created additional pressure on resolving this issue once and for all. And most of the pressure is going to be placed on Justice Kennedy. In fact, if you read Judge Feldman out of Louisiana's case closely, he almost seems to be trying to play a little bit to Kennedy and some of the arguments that Kennedy made in the previous Windsor decision to kind of say, look, I know that the court has kind of stayed out of the gay marriage, saying it's just not the federal government's place to do it. But when you decide the state, can the states decide it? I want you to remember this, Justice Kennedy. So it's not clear how the court will see it, but it is clear there's going to continue to be pressure and more cases coming forward. This isn't stopping. This is continuing to move forward.
What makes a case more or less likely to be picked up, and where do you see Wisconsin in that list?
Well, one of the key things, the Wisconsin case is quite interesting because everybody watches Posner, but there's this long been this theory about how we look at the court, that the court looks to do what we call error correction, that if they see bad decisions out there, it's their job to step in and reverse those decisions. In this particular case, though, it's a little different because you have the overwhelming weight of the federal court evidence, you know, federal court decision making indicating that they do not support same-sex, you know, marriage bans. And so, you know, the question is, can they make enough of a compelling case that puts enough pressure on the Supreme Court that they're going to go ahead and have to resolve this tough issue?
Now, we talked a little bit at the beginning about a New Orleans federal judge upholding Louisiana's same-sex marriage ban. So how does that piece of the puzzle factor in?
Well, part of it is that it comes down in terms of the arguments that get made. But when you look across the different circuits in the district courts, I mean, it's pretty clear that Judge Feldman is in a very, you know, quiet minority out there. Now, it has been the case that if you look at the appellate courts, there are dissents. A number of them are 2-1 dissents. So we don't want to paint a picture that somehow the federal courts are all unified and that, you know, gay marriage is going to happen, because it's about the arguments that are within the case. And it looks like what Feldman is trying to do is to say, I'm trying to crystallize the arguments that the state is putting forward regarding it's the interest that it has in protecting traditional marriage. And so to that extent, it's going to be in the same company as some of those other dissenting opinions that they've had at the Circuit Court of Appeal level.
What do you see as the options on Wisconsin's law going forward now that this ruling has come down?
Well, I think it's just going to continue. You make the decision that you're going to go ahead and press the case. You're going to push forward, and you're either going to make a decision that you're going to appeal it, or you're going to say, hey, you know what, this is costing us a lot of money and a lot of political capital, and we're not interested in doing that. So it's going to be incumbent upon the attorney generals in this case to sit down and have a serious conversation about how they want to expend their resources on litigation. One of the reasons why the 32 states have asked the Supreme Court to settle the gay marriage issue is because a great deal of time, energy, effort, resources on the part of state governments, either defending bans or striking down, you know, or allowing gay marriage, it's just a lot of time and energy is being spent on this. And the result is that we have these series of patchwork rulings out there. I would say the best bet, and it's hard to know where this is going, but one thing that most commentators are talking about is that Kennedy will come down on the side of, if you want to have gay marriage, then states can have it, and if they want to ban it, they want to ban it. They can ban it, that it's something that's within the state's jurisdiction. And that's one of the outcomes. When you look at the Windsor case, they walked a fine line there with just saying that the federal government can't regulate it, but not resolving the issue of what the states could do. I think it is vitally important to look at the part of Posner's decision that talks about Loving versus Virginia and interracial marriage. And he makes a strong case, and it's clear he's trying to align the case here with the Loving decision back in 1967, that this is no different from the bans on interracial marriage. And it just as those fell, it's time for these to fall.
Well, a lot of eyes on this one. We're going to keep watching it. Kimmy, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Keep up the great work, folks.
All right. Thanks a lot. We've been speaking with Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, about the future of Wisconsin's same-sex marriage case. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. For parents across the nation, this is the week they either dreaded or couldn't wait for. It's back to school week.
It's also the time we send our kids out into the great unknown, the world of school lunches. That's got lots of parents packing their own lunchboxes for the kids. But how do you make sure you're packing a healthy lunch and one that your kid will actually eat?
It's the topic of today's Food Friday. Here to give us some ideas is Anna Thomas Bates. She's a freelance writer. She blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. She writes a weekly column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's food section. Anna, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Well, after sending your kids off to school this week, how are you feeling?
Oh, we're feeling good. The kids will be home on the bus pretty soon, hungry and ready for a snack and a nice relaxing weekend.
And so, you know, you're someone who thinks a lot about food. What are you thinking as you put together your child's lunchbox?
You know, I think of a couple things. One, I try to keep in mind how little time they have to eat. So I try to keep things simple and quick for them. Also, I keep in mind allergies. There's a lot of kids where you can't bring peanuts or tree nuts to school. And I also want to make sure that it's something that they're going to eat and that is going to give them some fuel for the rest of the afternoon.
Yeah, sometimes with school lunches with my kids, I feel like what happens at school stays at school. You don't know if the food got eaten or traded or creatively discarded. How do you try to make sure the stuff you're packing is something that they're actually going to eat?
You know, we just have a really open dialogue, and at the beginning of each week or on the weekend, we talk about what they'd like to have in their lunches that week, what things they liked, what things they didn't like, and I really try to have them involved. They either will help me shop, or sometimes they actually will help me prepare the lunch. They can make their own sandwiches, they can slice up cheese, but I just make sure they have a hand in it so that they feel like they are stakeholders and, you know, chose what they got in their lunchbox that day.
That seems so obvious, but I bet a lot of us don't do it. My family doesn't always do that. And they're not just asking for Twinkies and Oreos?
No, but they haven't had a lot of those things, so on purpose, so... No, they ask for, and I'll be specific, I'll say, what kind of fruits or vegetables do you want today?
Mm-hmm. So sandwiches are an old standby, except for my kids, who really, for some reason, never got into sandwiches. I don't quite get that. So what are some good alternatives for that lunchbox entree?
Yeah, you know, you can do kind of a switch on the old sandwich. You know, you could do a wrap, they have those cute little mini pita pockets. You could put something on an English muffin, or you can go totally different. A lot of times we'll do kind of a charcuterie platter, and we'll have some, you know, sliced dry salami and some dates and some carrots and hummus, and kind of just a bunch of little things put together that they can graze on and have a variety to choose from.
But how do you fit a platter in the lunchbox?
Well, I kind of have some created little Tupperwares that have nice little sections. So
okay.
I have more tiny Tupperwares than larger ones.
What has been a greatest hit so far?
You know, they're pretty basic. They really like the dried fruit. They like, we do some homemade trail mix. They like muffins. They also like some leftover dinner favorites. We have a thermos for each of them. And if we do some homemade mac and cheese or pizza or soup, they definitely like to take that the next day as well.
And speaking of muffins, in the piece you wrote, you wanted to get something a little special. So in advance, you made some muffins. Why are you sending the kids to school with muffins this week?
You know, muffins is like the best all-purpose food. You can, if you put the right things into them, I feel good about giving them to kids for breakfast, for a snack, or even a dessert. So, you know, if you add in a little bit of whole grain flour, you can add in, you know, some protein things and some dried fruit. But you can also add in some nice things like a little bit of dark chocolate to make it seem special.
Now, you've got a recipe for chocolate cherry muffins that your kids like. Can you walk us through that one? What's in it?
Sure. It's a pretty basic muffin recipe. The highlights are, you can do half regular all-purpose flour, half whole wheat for a little added whole grain. We use dried cherries, or this time of year, fresh cherries are really wonderful too, and a little bit of dark chocolate.
Mm. That's pretty simple. We've got a recipe, or you've got a recipe, I should say, in your Milwaukee Journal Sentinel piece. We put a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. The fresh cherries, they bake up the same as the dried cherries, more or less?
Yeah, they do. They'll have a little bit more color. The color will bleed a little bit, but they're still very delicious.
I kind of like that in muffins when the berry color bleeds into the other stuff, like blueberries.
Stop, you two. You're making me crave muffins.
Okay, I got to go.
We've got two more hours of show.
To the muffin store.
All right, well, let's move on to peanut butter and jelly. You were talking about allergies with tree nuts and peanuts, and that's pretty common these days. So are there alternatives? Because that's long been a staple, but if you can't go that direction, what can you do?
Yeah, it's very common, and some schools these days won't even let you bring them to school, either the peanut butter or the tree nuts. And my kids are actually allergic to tree nuts. They're okay with peanuts, but not the alternative. So we use a lot of seeds and seed butters. So you can find sunflower seed butter quite readily at most grocery stores these days. And basically any recipe that calls for any kind of nut, if you substitute in sunflower seeds, raw pumpkin seeds, or even a mix of sesame seeds and chia seeds, which are smaller but still add some protein, you can get that same crunch and that same nutrition level.
You know, a big problem I have with packing school lunches sometimes is I'm doing it in a hurry, maybe after dinner. I haven't planned ahead. What are the keys to make sure you have on hand from the grocery store or to prepare maybe the weekend before so that you're not scrambling at the last second?
You know, if you're going to kind of put some stuff together from scratch, you have to put the time in at some point. So it's nice to do it ahead and do it early. So on the weekends, we'll usually pick one kind of more treat snacky thing, either a big batch of granola, a big batch of muffins, or a batch of cookies that have some whole wheat and some oatmeal in there for a little bit more nourishment. And we'll make at least a big batch of that on the weekend, which will serve as either after-school snacks or as kind of a dessert and a lunch all week. Cutting up things like carrots are really nice to have on hand, and cauliflower. A lot of kids really do like raw, crunchy vegetables, especially if you pair them with a nice dip like a hummus or a ranch dressing. Mm. So doing some of that prep time ahead of time, and also easy things like boiling up eggs. A hard-boiled egg makes a great, very easy lunch.
Now, it sounds like the two of you do a lot of your lunch prepping the night before. Is that, I don't know, I always thought the lunch would get sort of, you know, when things have been sitting in the freezer and they kind of harden, or the refrigerator. Is there an ideal time to prepare the food? Is the night before better, or is the morning of best?
You know, I do better if I do it the night before, just because I have more time to put some thought into it. But you're right, you do have to think about it. If you're making, you know, a lot of sandwiches may not be so great the night before. So one thing you could do is, if you were doing something like tuna or egg salad, you could at least have the filling ready and then put it on the bread the morning of. Other things, if, you know, I don't know how many kids actually take salad to lunch, but definitely keep your dressing separate, or this is maybe for more adult lunches, or do a kale salad, which actually improves over time with dressing on it.
Okay, so let's get to the end of the school day. The kids have expended calories learning wonderful things and at recess and whatnot. They're hungry again when they get home. What's on hand for the after-school snack?
You know, it's such a balancing act because if you don't give them anything, then by 4:30 they're in the kitchen just harassing you to the point where you're ready just to throw graham crackers at them, and then you have no chance of getting them to eat dinner. But they're also hungry and their blood sugar's low and they've, you know, been doing a job all day. So I like to have something small with a little bit of protein or fat in it to keep them sustained until, you know, 5 or 5:30 when we have dinner, but not have them so filled up that they won't eat dinner, because hungry kids do a lot better at dinner about trying new things and eating the healthy things they should. So we'll either do something really basic like a whole piece of fruit, or we'll kind of go back onto that big batch thing I made, either a little bit of granola and yogurt or a granola bar, something just with a little bit of sweetness to lift their blood sugar, but also some protein and fat just to keep them steady until the dinner hour.
Some lessons we can apply to the public radio world there too. Anna, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
That's Anna Thomas-Bates. She's a freelance food writer. She blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. We've got a link to her article with that muffin recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
According to a new poll from Reason Magazine, 68% of Americans think it should be illegal for kids 9 and under to play unsupervised in parks. 43% say it should be illegal for kids aged 12. Our next guest says adults today have unrealistic attitudes about how dangerous the world is and the capabilities of kids. Her advice, let kids get out and play. They're going to be all right.
Lenore Skenazy joins us now. She's a public speaker, blogger, and author of the book and blog Free Range Kids. Lenore, thanks for being here.
Where I'm from.
Well, looking at those results again, 68% of respondents said it should be illegal for kids 9 and under to play alone. 43% said the same thing for 12-year-olds. What does that say to you?
Well, it says to me so many things that I'm glad we have half an hour. But basically it says that we think that children need our eyes upon them almost every single second of every single day, or else they're in horrible danger, which is such a disconnect with the fact that we're living in pretty much the safest times in human history that it boggles my mind every time I think about it. I don't know about you, but when I was 9, I was on my bike, I was riding to the library in Wilmette, Illinois, and nobody was sitting at home thinking, oh my God, I hope she makes it, this is so terrible, I just am counting the seconds, because that's not the way people used to think. They used to have a better grasp of reality, but now we're all supposed to think in terms of how we'd feel if our children ended up dead in almost any situation. That's really what you're encouraged to do. Imagine the very worst case scenario, and then think about how terrible you'd feel, and the news coverage, and the funeral, and finally you just don't let your kids do anything. And even if you do, now there's a percentage of the population, a majority, that wants to see you arrested if you so much as trust your kid playing in the park.
Well, I mean, let's talk about the news, because you do turn on the news on any given day or flip through the paper, mm-hmm. and there is that horrible story there that makes you clench your teeth and pull your hair mm-hmm. out and freak out, basically. And you think, you know, well, someone is drawing that unlucky number. It better not be my kid. I better not be the parent who lets down their guard. Isn't there something to that?
There's a lot to it. Every emotion that you've just mentioned is one that I know I've felt and that I think that a lot of other parents feel. But it is a false idea that there's some way of keeping our kids absolutely perfectly safe. And if we only don't let them do anything ever, or are attached to them, whether by GPSing them or holding their hand or watching them like a hawk until they're 18, we will keep them safe. There's this weird new idea that unless we are personally with them, they are not safe. But if we are apart from them, they are suddenly unsafe, and that's just not the case. I mean, you know, if we're worrying about kids dying, and I think that's what we were just talking about, I mean,
the number one way kids die is as passengers in cars, passengers in cars in car seats and with loving parents who are driving them around. And so if we really wanted to freak out every time we thought our kids were in danger, we should freak out every time we put them in the car. Oh, my God, what if today's the day? I don't want that number to be mine. But we don't do that. We've only dangerized the idea of kids being outside playing. We don't dangerize or over fret the idea of kids driving around with us in cars, because we have a grasp of, yes, it's not perfectly safe, but it's extremely safe, and it's that tiny risk that's just present in all life, and that's one I'm willing to take. But somehow we're not willing to take it in even the more safe situation of a kid walking or playing outside.
Well, maybe we will be freaking about it now that we've thought about it a little more today.
That is the one thing I do freak out about.
Speaking strictly for me. Yeah, and you apparently. But, I mean, is there anything to the notion that the world is so much more dangerous now? I mean, sometimes one feels like, you know, every other person is a pedophile if you're reading the paper. I mean, do we need to? Is it less safe or not?
It's actually more safe today than it was any time since 1963, which is... Oh, you know what? I'm actually on somebody's phone. Talk about unsafe. My neighbor left her door open so I could use her landline.
That's nice.
And now her child and babysitter have come home. Hi, I'm on the phone talking to a radio station about safety. And here, let me just give you a couple facts, which are that, what was I saying? Oh, so the crime rate today is back to what it was when gas was 29 cents a gallon, back to what it was when stamps cost 5 cents. Back to the rate it was when I was a kid, frankly. And if you were growing up any time in the 60s, 70s, 80s, or 90s, it was actually less safe outside than it is today. But you're right. You turn on the TV and it feels like everybody's a predator. There's a pedophile behind every bush. You can't possibly trust your kids with any adult who isn't you. And even you are supposed to be, you know, a little worried about yourself. Who knows? And it's just the media has decided to concentrate on the story that gets the most reaction, gets people glued to the television the most. And that's why from the news to Law and Order to Dexter to you name it, Criminal Minds to the Bruckheimer films, it's all about children in danger, because that gets the most reaction and keeps us glued to the screen.
Is part of it also that maybe as a group parents don't believe that much in the capabilities of kids and in what they can actually pull off by themselves?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question, because you know, parents don't think that they're selling their kids short, and nobody really feels they're doing that. But a message that a kid gets is like, don't go out without me. I'll be there with you. Honey, I have to be there. It's not that I don't trust you. It's I don't trust anyone else in the world. The message that the kid gets is, oh, you do not trust me. And actually, that is, it's a legitimate thing for them to feel, because in a way, we are selling them short. I mean, my mom, you know, sent me to school at age kindergarten. We would walk to school on our own, and then back then the crossing guard was another kid. I mean, it was a kid who was a sixth grader. So what is that? That's age 11. That's the age that 43% of Americans don't think that children should even be at the park without supervision. And yet back then they were trusted to get us across the street. So they had to stand in the street and take, you know, these little kids whose parents weren't with them, they had to shepherd them safely to school. So what are we doing today that we're saying we don't trust our kids walking to school, we don't trust our kids outside at all, even at the age that we used to think they could be babysitting or being crossing guards or have a paper route? It is too bad that we've been told not to trust our kids in almost any situation. And there's a bunch of reasons I think that we've been told that, but the upshot is the kids get the message, Mom loves me a whole lot. They totally love me, but they just don't think I'm competent.
Well, I can remember when I was a kid roving around with gangs of kids and, you know, creating fanciful worlds for ourselves and doing things like that. And, you know, I get my kids actually don't do that. I don't know why. Maybe I guess it's me. I have to do some soul searching after this segment.
But it's not just you. That's what I want to always say. It's not it's not that each of us has become an erotic nut job on our own, suddenly thinking up, you know, all these scary, horrible things and how we'd feel talking on Anderson Cooper explaining, I just turned my head for a second and he was gone. That's a cultural thing that has happened. It's what I call worst first thinking. We are encouraged to think of the worst case scenario first and proceed as if it's likely to happen. And the way I discovered that, if I can rattle on a little more
yeah.
now here. Okay. Well, the reason I'm talking to you at all today is because 6 years ago at this point, I let my 9-year-old ride the subway by himself. And I'm a newspaper columnist by trade, and so I wrote a column about why I let my 9-year-old ride the subway by himself. And I ended up on all these talk shows. And it took me, I'm such a slow learner, it took me several years to realize that my crime was not letting him go on subterranean public transportation. My crime was that when they would look at me and say, but Lenore, weren't you worried? Didn't you think about how you'd feel if he didn't come home? Or they'd say, how would you have felt if he didn't come home? As if there was a question. And obviously there wasn't a question. It was just a chiding way of saying, if you had thought that way, you would never have let him go. So your crime was not thinking about the worst thing that could possibly happen to him. And after being asked that question so many times, how would you have felt if he didn't come home, I realized that that's the question we've been trained to ask ourselves before we let our kids do what you're saying you're not letting your kids do, and most people don't let their kids do anymore either, which is roam around in packs with their friends outside on a beautiful Saturday afternoon, having fun and making up countries and playing in the vacant lot and riding their bikes and all the stuff that we remember so fondly. We don't think we can let our kids do anymore because we think, no, we're supposed to imagine them dead. And if you start imagining them dead, you don't let them do anything.
Yeah, there's very little any of us would do if we just imagined that all day. But
right, exactly.
What do you think the kids themselves lose out on because that attitude has shifted?
Right. Well, I think that the thing that I hadn't realized until I started writing about this for the last zillion years now is just how important what's called free play is. And free play is not Little League. Little League is great, but it has nothing to do with imagination or problem solving or even exercise quite as much as when you're running around on your own in a pack, when you have to come up with a game that everybody's willing to play, and you have to decide for yourselves whether the ball is in or out and whether the game should continue or not. And if you don't get your turn, you can either stomp off, which is the way a baby reacts, like having a tantrum, or you can hold yourself together and go to the back of the line and wait your turn because that's what everybody's telling you to do. You know, it's your gang of friends, and that's the only way the game will continue for you is if you suck it up and sort of act mature, and that's how we get maturity. That's why we play. Mother Nature gave us the drive to play like she gave everybody a little older the drive to procreate. It's a way of teaching us the most important lessons that we need to survive, from cooperation to problem solving to holding it together when you're scared or angry. And taking it away and replacing it with supervised and organized activities, those are great. And my kids have been in plenty on their own, too. But there's something critical, crucial, primal, and just plain old lovely that is lost when we don't let them roam around in the packs you were talking about.
We're talking right now with Lenore Skenazy. She's a public speaker, TV host, and author of the book and blog Free Range Kids. And we're talking about a recent poll that shows a large number of poll responders think that it should be illegal for kids 9 and under to play unsupervised. A lot of people think the same holds true for kids who are 12-year-olds, too. And we're thinking about what that says about raising kids today and what that means for the Free Range Kid movement.
And we want to hear from you. Why do you think so many adults are worried about kids playing unsupervised, maybe at the park? Is that fear justified? Do you let your kids run wild and free without adults nearby? And did you roam free range when you were a kid? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Lenore Skenazy. She is a public speaker, blogger. She has a book and blog called Free Range Kids, talking about a recent poll from Reason Magazine saying that a large number of people think it should be illegal for kids 9 and under to play unsupervised in a park. And a lot of people, 43% around there, say the same thing about kids who are 12 years old. And we're thinking about what this says about parenthood today.
And we want to hear from you. Why do you think adults are worried here? Does it make sense to be that cautious, or are we way too cautious? Do you let your own kid play without adults nearby? What was your childhood like? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our phones now. Becky is with us from Nina. Hi, Becky.
Hello. Hi, I guess I struggle with this issue. I have a 9-year-old girl and a 10-year-old boy, and I have been pushing myself to let them venture out and go for bike rides with their friends. And I realize that it's important for their confidence and self-esteem to be able to do these things. But I recently was volunteering at a back-to-school fair, and we had a group there talking about sexual abuse awareness. And in my community, which I consider a very safe community, our rates are one in three girls by the age of 18 and one in four boys by the age of 18. And I realize that's higher than the national standard, but they do believe that we just have more awareness and reporting. So I guess I'm wondering, how am I supposed to wrap my brain around that and feel comfortable sending my kids out into the world knowing, I mean, one in three is a very scary statistic.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks a lot for bringing that up, Becky. Yeah, that's the kind of thing I guess parents have to grapple with on this, Lenora.
Well, that's parents and apparently adults. If we're talking one in three, that's an outrageously high number. I haven't heard that number from any place, and I'm really sorry to hear it. What I've been telling people to do and what I've told my own kids to do is learn the three R's, because as Becky probably knows, and as I'm sure you know, and most of your listeners know, is that the vast majority of crimes against children are not committed by strangers. They're committed by people they know, often a family member or close family friend, somebody that is trusted. And so being afraid of stranger danger actually puts your emphasis in the wrong direction in terms of keeping kids really safe. So the three R's that I've taught my kids, and that the Boy Scouts teach kids, and it's universal, it's not just me, is to recognize, resist, and report abuse. And I'm just going to go through them really fast, if that's okay, because I actually do think they save a lot of kids. Recognize nobody can touch you where your bathing suit covers. You can do this with kids as young as three. That's just recognition. Resist is, you know, bad people like good people. Nobody wants a lot of work, and they will go for, most people prefer a job that's easy rather than hard. Make it hard for anybody who wants to bother you by resisting, okay? Not that you can blame a victim, but resisting is good. Kick, scream, run away. And finally, report. The molester's biggest trick up his sleeve is silence, and buying that silence through a threat or a bribe or whatever. But if you tell your kids that whenever something happens that makes them unhappy or disturbs them, they can come to you, tell you everything, and you will not be mad at them. They will not get into any trouble. You are taking away probably the biggest arrow in the molester's quiver, because you've taken away the silence and the secretism on which they thrive. So for Becky and for everybody else who's listening, the three R's are going to help your kid certainly more than just telling them never go outside and don't walk to the park and don't walk to school.
Okay, well, thank you so much for bringing that up, Becky. I appreciate that. And Lenora, thank you for going through the three R's with us as well. And we're going to go next to Janie in Wausau. Hi, Janie.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you. So this has really been a big, hot topic with some friends of mine. We all have kids kind of getting to the age where they should be able to be independent. And it's just so much making your own decision about how much you're going to allow your kids to do without you. I have an 8-year-old, almost 9-year-old, and an almost 7-year-old, and then an almost 4-year-old. As much as it is really dealing with the adult's response to that, because I feel like you either get it, if you share your decision or the neighbors see your kids outside playing, you either get the look or a response of your negligent parent, or you get the look or a response of your helicopter parent. And it's really, I think,
it's true.
Yeah, it's really hard for us, like, to be like solid and confident in my decision of making the right choice for each of my individual kids, because that choice is a little different for each one of them.
Right. Yeah. Right. Thanks a lot, Janie. And it can be hard to win. Maybe we just go around feeling bad about ourselves all the time.
She is so right. And not only are we hard on ourselves, it's become the number one spectator sport in America is commenting on everyone else's parenting. I think that's, you know, like even when celebrities are pregnant, I mean, there's the bump watch. I mean, we're just fascinated by the whole idea of parenting now. I'm not quite sure why. But that's one of the reasons that I try not to say, oh, if you don't raise your kids this exactly my way, which even I don't raise my kids exactly my way all the time, that something terrible will happen to them or that you're a terrible parent. I think she's right. You know your kids. You know they're all different. Sometimes you make a lousy decision. You look back on it. You go, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Nobody is perfect. And the idea that you have to be perfect is a wild one, because if we had to be perfect, there wouldn't be a human species. You know, throughout most of history, the parents were 14-year-olds, right? And they didn't read Dr. Spock. They didn't have no attachment parenting. They didn't read me, even. Hard to believe. And yet they managed to, you know, keep the species going. We've got 7 billion of us on the planet. So the idea that you have to do everything right or a certain way is ridiculous. And the only confidence I would try to give parents is to realize that they don't have to be perfect. I hope they don't think that I'm saying that you must be, you know, let your kids go at age 5 and then by 7 they have to be cooking dinner and by 9 they have to be those, you know, crossing guards. Otherwise, they've lost every opportunity to develop a soul. That's not what I'm saying. My book and my blog and Free Range Kids Everything is not about how to parent. It's only about trying to understand and detox from the overweening fear that's been shoved down our throats by, you know, Nancy Grace and Law and Order and warnings sent out by the school whenever a van passes a bus stop. I just am sick of the idea that our children are in constant danger, and that's all I'm trying to do is just fight that idea, because I find that idea a lie.
There's a comment here from Facebook I want to read. This is from Brian. He says, wow, I was babysitting in third grade. If you hired a third grader these days, you'd be arrested. People really need to stop living in fear and enjoy the world around them. What do you say to that?
That's beautiful. And that's one of the things that I sometimes get to in my more philosophical moments is that, you know, we are so lucky to be living in this era. It's true that, you know, there's still crime and the world is imperfect and there's pollution and there's some bad people. But compared to the most of human history, if you told a person 200 years ago that, guess what, I'm going to transport you to a time when there's clean water, we've gotten rid of diphtheria, nobody gets polio, famine is a thing of the past in this country, and your children can walk outside with the crime rate of 1963 as opposed to the crime rate of like London in 1,000 or whatever. It is the safest time in human history. And it's not just me saying that. It's Steven Pinker at Harvard that wrote this book, Our Better Angels, where he analyzed it and he found that we really are, despite wars and pestilence and bad things, and we're still living in the safest times that humans have ever seen. And to be ungrateful for that and to say, oh, my God, these are such terrible times, I can't possibly let go of my kid without GPSing them and making sure that they got on the bus and standing at the bus stop and making sure I escort them home, is a little bit of ingratitude for something that the rest of the world and the rest of history would have killed for.
In our last minute here, I want to ask you, if someone is listening now and they think, I do want to allow my kids a bit of a longer leash and see where it gets all of us, and, you know, maybe I've taken the 3 R's into consideration, I've made a reason choice, what can they do to take some baby steps?
Well, I'll give you a couple baby steps from my book. One is when you're at the bus stop with your kid, and I'm at the bus stop with my kid, and there's 5 other parents with 5 other kids, offer to watch them all. Say, look, I don't think anything so horrible is going to happen between now and the time the school bus gets here. I will watch them all. And you're sort of asserting the safety of the situation and creating a little bit of community. We're in this together. I'm not going to rape all 8 of your kids when you go to Starbucks. Just leave them with me, and it'll be okay. And another suggestion in my book is one day, just try this experiment. Leave your cell phone at home. Because even if you ask your kids to do it, they wouldn't. But if you don't have your cell phone and your kids are trying to reach you and they can't, they'll have to make some decisions by themselves. Can they go to the park? Can they eat a cookie? Do they have to do their homework first, or can they watch TV? Let them make some of their own decisions. We all thrive when we determine our own after-school activities.
All right, we'll leave it there. Lenore, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Veronica. I really appreciate it, and thank you to the callers.
We've been speaking with Lenore Scanese, public speaker, blogger. She's got a book and a blog called Free Range Kids.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.